Now keep going. Keep talking, just like you were.
Oh.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I was so ready for an intro.
No, yeah, no, I'm kind of over the intros now.
Okay.
Well, post intro.
I think I'm gonna try and sneak these openings. I'm gonna sneak these recording starts. Maybe I stopped already. Maybe I haven't even started.
Blowing my mind right now.
What Detoy does is they have a little bit of talking, and then they throw the theme song in, and then they just keep talking. There's no introductions or anything, but that's one of my favorite podcasts.
Do they cut the music from the voice?
I think that they editing magic things together.
Yeah. I used to do that, and that is a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
It literally makes it 5 more minutes longer than it needs to be.
Fuck, 5 minutes.
The key to a good podcast is never editing it, ever.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, Jeff, the white PS3 is sublime. It's godly. I've played with it for a week now. It's amazing.
Griffin, you should become one of us and get a top-loading PS3.
I played Ni No Kuni for 6 hours today, and I felt the back of it, and it was warm, but it didn't feel like I could warm my coffee on it.
Did you feel
like...
You
just didn't have that George Foreman love?
Did you feel like there was a jet taking off in your room?
No, even at the highest setting, the fan is like just whisper quiet. It's awesome. Yes.
Although the disc read sounds can sometimes be hilariously loud.
What's up with that? Because it's just when it decides to actually spool up the disc, it beeps. So it's like beep, 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 zzz, beep, beep.
Not on mine.
Did you buy the R2-D2 version?
Maybe it's just the sound of the disc spinning that sounds like a beep to me. But it's audible over... I mean, it's definitely not like a deal breaker at all. I love the thing, but yeah, definitely when the disc decides to spin, it's like, okay, listen to this now.
Yeah, it's very loud. I don't care at all because I really love that form factor for reasons that I cannot fully articulate.
I was trying to explain to Griffin that it is really the size of a Wii U, kind of.
Yes,
if you turn the Wii U on, it's Griffin. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's so small.
The launch model is like 12 pounds, and that model is like 4 points.
Oh, wait, the launch model is 12 pounds, and the new one's how many?
Like 4.5.
Oh, man. That's like the outer extremes of fat and neonatal baby weight right there.
That's actually what they were, that's the metaphor they were trying to construct.
The first Sony PlayStation 3 Super Slim was birthed by... Kaz Tarai.
Do you guys remember that baby ad that they did with the crying baby?
No.
For
what?
PlayStation 2?
No, that was for PlayStation 3.
No.
It was the one with the room with no windows or doors, and the baby was in there, and there were just screens all along the walls, and they were showing PlayStation 3 games, and then a tear rolled out of the baby's eye. You don't remember this?
No, that sounds like Attitude Era, like babies wearing spike collars and shit.
It's more like avant-garde, crazy, terrifying Sony ad. I'm going to look it up right now.
Sounds to me like a wet dream you had.
I believe you, Jeff. I believe you.
Here it is.
You're not crazy, Jeff.
I'm going to show it to you guys, and you guys should watch it because it's really terrifying. And I'm telling you, this is Sony's master plan.
I would get a top loader, but I like having the PS2 backward compatibility. And hey, I've made it this far.
That's true. I was a little bummed to give up the backwards compat, but I can always just buy it.
You didn't keep it? You traded it in?
I sold it.
Oh, wow. I am, because you hold on to your stuff.
Not anymore. I've been doing a lot better. Like, I went and recently traded in my 3DS for a double credit.
Double credits.
You have an old 3DS, and you have an XL 3DS as well?
I have an old 3DS. I have a red XL 3DS, and I have a Pikachu XL 3DS. I gave the red XL to Jessica, though.
Okay,
so it all...
yeah. Why do you have the old one still?
Because I just hadn't gotten around to selling it yet.
Okay.
Jessica was insistent that she wanted the old 3DS,
right?
And then it came time to go on our vacation, and she was looking at me playing Animal Crossing on the bigger 3DS and was like, that looks nice. I want a bigger one. So she took the bigger one.
I wonder how many people like buy the consoles over and over and over again, and how many people just, this is like their first one, you know? Like, how many people's Super Slim, that's like their first? And how many people's Super Slim is
like... How far does the bloodline go back?
Yeah, like, exactly. Yeah.
I think there are a lot of repeat buyers. I think they factor that into their calculations.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, not enough to buoy any particular redesign, but there are a fair number. Mm-hmm. Or I'm just a huge sucker.
We're all suckers. It's all right. Yeah. Consumer whores.
Yes. Anyway, though.
So, you guys, Jeff, how was your vacation?
It was good. I've been playing this game. It's a hot new indie title. It's called Euro Cruise Simulator.
Oh, I think I've heard of it. 2013.
So, yes. It is a resource management simulator. Is it
early access?
Yes, it's green light.
Is there trading cards?
No, it is resource-based, though. The resource is 110-volt outlets. Mm. And you have to afford them so you can charge your 3DS.
Oh, so it's like hopscotch across Europe.
Yes.
Jumping from...
I was on vacation for 2.5 weeks. It was pretty cool. I went to a bunch of countries. I didn't play too much in the way of games, except for some Animal Crossing and some Donkey Kong and some more 3DS stuff. And I got a cold.
Were you on a boat? Were you on a boat?
I was on a boat.
Have you been on cruises before, or is this the first?
I have been on cruises before, unfortunately. They're very strange. It is like a bizarro world.
They terrify me.
Yeah, they are kind of terrifying.
I've never been on one.
I've never been on one either, and I really...
They're really weird.
As I understand it, you're just like going about your business, and then you're literally standing in a pile of shit. That's what I understand. That's what the news tells me.
I always have the feeling that you're suddenly inside another boat. I feel like it would be like if you lived in a shopping mall and like you were grown in a shopping mall and that's all you ever knew as like the world. And then like occasionally you left the shopping mall and got to like go to parking lots and you're like, oh my gosh, look at the horizon. It's so beautiful. And then you're like, well, back into the shopping mall. And then you go out to the other exit, and you're like, oh, wow, look, there's rain on this side. This is like a new life experience. And you're like, okay, well, Leon Chien's, here we go again.
Can you tell me why the poop accumulates on the floor and not in the ocean?
You actually elect to have the poop accumulate on you.
Okay.
I was going to say, Griffin, it is kind of like that. It is sort of like this weird little world that is distinct from reality. And when you're on the boat, it's like you're in that reality. And then when you leave the boat, you're like, oh, this isn't the entire world. And then you get back on and you're...
Anyone else with a 3DS on the boat?
Not that I saw.
No.
Does being on a cruise ship make you just feel like the whitest white fucker ever? Like you get off on these locations and you're like, oh my, just went on my moving island house apartment complex.
Yeah, I kind of hate that. It's like... If there were any way to stand out as a tourist, you would be getting off a giant fucking boat. Mm-hmm. But we didn't do too badly. We didn't do as badly as some of the older people who carried the cruise lines, like branded paraphernalia with them as they toured.
Oh, that's good.
We were actually in one of the places we went. We actually witnessed a mugging of people who were carrying branded stuff. And we were not carrying anything branded, so the muggers left us alone.
I think what the cruise ship should do is they should like have one of those children safety lines, and they attach, like they put a harness on you, and you connect the harness to the boat, so you can only walk so far away from the boat.
They should be able to at any time just press a button, and then you just get reeled back in
exactly,
really fast.
Yeah, you have like you yank on it twice, and then some people just start pulling you back. All the Disney singers start pulling you back.
Something about cruise lines actually is that the entertainment on them is always really, really bad.
Oh, I can only imagine.
Hilariously so. It's like the Broadway, the off-Broadway rejects. The only ones you get on the cruise ships. But yeah, it was cool. It's not really the kind of thing that I would choose to do ordinarily, but I had a good time with my fam.
Oh, that's awesome.
So.
You didn't get seasick. Well, I guess you kind of got seasick, but not really like. Do you find any pirates?
No pirates. I actually did get sick a couple times. I got motion sick.
Did you commit any crimes in international waters?
Diplomatic immunity.
Not that I can report on this podcast. I was going to say, I did get sick a couple times. I got motion sick because people drive like fucking lunatics in Europe. And I got a stomach bug, and then I told you I got my cold. But no, I did not get seasick, fortunately.
What was the coolest place?
I would say the coolest place was Odessa in Ukraine, which was like this charming little city, which I think was kind of styled after like Paris. But it was really nice. We
not
just
to
walked
be confused with Odessa, Texas.
Yes, not to be confused.
Okay.
And we also saw these awesome catacombs that members of the partisan resistance in Ukraine used to evade the Romanian and Ukrainian Nazi sympathizers.
Mm. Did you stop in Latveria?
No.
Visit
we did
Dr.
not,
Doom?
We did not visit Dr. Doom. Is he from Latveria? Is
yeah,
that the country?
Latveria. That's, yep.
That's amazing.
Doomstad, the center of Latveria.
That is some writing right there.
How many Nazis did you meet, and are they zombies?
The Nazi and the zombie share a common ancestor. No, we did not meet any, although we did see some awesome propaganda.
Is it just human?
the common ancestor?
Yeah. Once a man?
It is a pharaoh.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, so I got back and then I looked at our Google Doc and I saw the words lightning boobs. Tell me what that's about.
Oh, you don't know? You missed out on so much, Jeff. That's what all that time in Europe has done to you. Is you don't even, it's like,
you don't even know what's going on.
You don't even, yeah, you don't even know to be incensed about lightning boobs because you've spent so much time in this other, you know, highly laissez-faire country.
So I think I heard a rumor, I think, on like NeoGAF or something that her bra cup was increased.
Yeah. Depending on the costume you equip on her, she will have a bigger cup size. And there are measurements that exist, and depending on what costume you equip, she can be more exposed and whatnot. This is all relating to Final Fantasy 13 Lightning Returns, the last great hope of Final Fantasy 13.
Mm. My favorite thing about this whole story is that when asked, a Square Enix person said, yeah, they'll jiggle.
Yeah.
And then he's like, and you can make sure they do, because when you change weapons on the item screen, her arm moves, and therefore boob moves.
Yep. Oh, no.
Yeah.
So, are you telling me that Square Enix is now Tecmo Koei or whatever?
Yep.
Yes.
Oh my
god. Dead or alive.
Oh, Jesus.
Somebody, Igaki's off somewhere in a basement smoking cigarettes and trying on leather jackets. Like, he is occupied and happy. Somebody else needs to be fulfilling that boob jiggle niche. 'Cause it sure isn't DOA.
You know, I was dangerously close to, like, renting this game at Redbox or something. But no. Just no.
Now that
why
there's
do they
boobs
do this
in
to
it?
Me? They build me up and they break me down.
You were really pumped for this at a point, like you were.
No, I was never pumped for this, but I was like, hey, you know what? I might rent this.
Is this going to become Sonic? Like every time there's a new Sonic game, we're all like, this could be good. It looks okay. And that's all.
I think
one might argue that's kind of been the whole Final Fantasy situation for the past 5 to 10 years.
Oh yeah, I wouldn't even argue with you. I just completely agree.
See, I liked 12 okay.
Sure.
I don't know. I thought 12 was a cool game.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you're right. There, people can like 12 and it's okay.
Yeah. It's not like other Final Fantasy at all. But I liked it.
Mm-hmm. I know a pretty good game too.
Caused me to throw my PlayStation 2 out the window.
To be fair, I didn't get as far as you did, Jamie. Also, that's a hilarious response to not liking one game.
I'm glad it was a slim because my NYU windows only open so much. Don't want us killing ourselves, but we can throw the PlayStation out the window.
That's right. Just enough to not hotbox it.
Would an OG not have fit, Jamie?
No. You can barely stick a cigarette out those suckers.
That's hilarious.
People find ways, Jeff, at NYU. They put up 13-foot glass walls in the library atrium. Someone still got up there. You know? It's not a joke, but it is funny.
That's what happens with bored kids, man. They just suck.
Yeah, exactly.
Better than getting pregnant and doing drugs. Stick them in a glass wall.
You can get pregnant through those windows, just barely.
It wasn't that the game was bad. It was that the game, I had super high expectations, astronomical, and they were not met, and I was furious.
Yeah, because the plot was like Star Wars. It was like, hey, this looks like a good Star Wars clone.
Yeah, if I went back to it now, I'm sure I'd have a much healthier attitude about it.
Which one was a Star Wars clone?
12, at least the part that I played of it.
Oh.
I mean, I kind of see what you're getting at, but it's like
maybe I needed to get farther before.
Wait, which Star Wars clone? A clone just like of which Star Wars?
It was like Han Solo.
And okay, so the good
like,
Star Wars.
Hey, let's go fly our ship and take on the Empire.
Not like Balthier was Jar Jar Binks and Pinello was Padme.
No.
Oh, okay.
I didn't even hate Vaughn. He was just there, me and Vaughn.
I just remember it doing kind of what the newest Zelda game did. What's it called? Sword Face?
Skyward Sword,
where there was just like a paucity of story for a huge stretch. Mm. And that's where I threw it out the window, because I was going from town to town, getting like almost nothing. Mm. And then I was just like, this is boring.
That's a shame.
Yeah,
I only got like 5 hours in, so I don't know.
I think I got slightly less than that.
The one thing that bummed me about it was the license board, in theory, was awesome, but just had no direction at all.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but it's interesting. So that was the first game, at least that I can remember, where Japanese games started doing this thing where you can move around a little bit and like on the battle board. And you control one character, but the others are doing their own thing. Mm. But you can switch over to them. Am I misremembering?
Yeah. Baldur's Gate-ish.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And at the time, I thought, this is terrible. I hope this never happens in any game ever again. And then, of course, it happens in all the games now.
Well, this was... the 12 was thanks to Xenogears folks, actually.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Huh.
Yep. No, but, 12 was worked on by FFT guy.
Oh yes, yeah. Sorry, and no. It wasn't a powerhouse. Wasn't? Oh,
no.
You're right. Yep.
Final Fantasy their names sound similar. Yeah.
You're right. Yep.
Final Fantasy. So now Tactics, it's though. In every game, and Ni no Kuni, which we can talk about later if you want, Ni no Kuni is the game where I feel like that actually works, and I'm having fun. And every time the battle's a little different, mm-hmm. and it's like fast, and I think it works in this game.
It works because it doesn't matter.
I think
really?
It matters, yeah. And you know, I think it works because the characters you switch between are distinct and have roles.
Exactly.
Whereas in 12, they just were blank slates, the blankest of blank.
Yeah, I need to do it. I mean, I die in Ni no Kuni sometimes. Maybe it's because I'm not working up enough. But if I just go in there and I just don't pay attention to some boss battles, I'll definitely die.
Absolutely.
If I think about it and I think, okay, first I'm going to use this Pokemon and then I'm going to switch over to the healing lady and then she's going to do something and I'll switch back. I'll use a different Pokemon.
Mm-hmm.
And then like it's actually – and then maybe like you have to keep an eye out for orbs.
I actually think that's the biggest flaw of the game is it doesn't commit in either direction far enough to say it's turn-based and slow enough that you can strategically design your movements. And it's not also open action-y enough so that your characters aren't dying without the amount of control it takes to manipulate the boss fights.
Mm-hmm.
How far have you gotten in Ni no Kuni? What's the last boss you fought?
Don't be too specific because I haven't beat it yet.
I will not. So I got the crafting option on the menu. Griffin, do you remember when you get that option, you have to fight a boss? And then you have unlocked that option.
Uh-huh. Yes. Yep.
So I just did that, which I'm at 12 hours, which is also...
Time out. Somebody got to stop touching their microphone.
Oh, that's probably me with my fan. Better.
Yeah, better.
So I'm 12 hours in, and I finally unlocked the last thing on the menu. This game is one of the – it's so – I mean, I love the game. I'll say that right off the bat. I'm in love with it. But it holds your hand. My hand is sore. My hand is a withered piece of crap. The game has grasped my hand for 12 hours, and it's finally just letting go just a little bit. It's like you don't even get
the Half-Blood Prince.
Exactly. You don't even have the option to train your own Pokemon until like 8 hours in.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Yeah. The game, it's a Pokemon game, but you can't catch Pokemon until 8 hours? It's insane. And you don't have a second party member until around about 6 to 8 hours. It's crazy. But then again, there is a lot to learn. And it seems to me like they're really aiming for this to be someone's first traditional RPG,
sure.
Or at least that's an option. Like if you're a 12-year-old, 10-year-old kid and you've never played a JRPG before, you could get into this. There's no barriers to entry.
You would not get very far, though, because that game is freaking hard.
Yeah, it's
Jamie,
hard.
The point that you're – the boss that you fought that you're referring to is the point in which I said, okay, I'm turning this down to easy and just having fun with it from here on out because
it is too hard. Yeah, that boss is insane.
Yes.
It shows you how well I think the battle system is crafted because you have these long epic battles where – your health is fluctuating wildly, and the enemies have phases like in a platformer, but it's like in an RPG.
I think the reason why I decided to turn it down there, though, is because I said to myself, okay, I can beat this guy, but it's going to take a little bit of grinding and a lot of items. And I was like, I am an item hoarder, and I don't want to use all my awesome stuff right now. So... Uh-huh. Either I let it all go, or else I have to just like bump it down to easy.
Or you just have to find. What I did with that boss was I just found there's always like one right Pokemon. There's like the one type that'll do you good. So I happened to be lucky that right before that boss, I did a fetch. I did a bunch of fetch quests, and I happened to be leveling up this one type that I had caught. And he happened to be like the perfect type.
Huh.
So,
which one was this? Are you talking about?
He's an owl. He's a dark type or a moon type, I guess, is the thing. And he worked well for some reason. The other guys weren't really landing hits.
Interesting.
But he was landing hits, and he was also evading well, which with this particular boss is a huge thing because this boss
has devastating.
Huge wide attacks, and you need to get the hell out of there.
Yeah. So the reason why I think that the game is flawed, but also really it doesn't commit far enough in either direction where you have to like once this boss like starts up their super ultra mega powerful cutscene attack, once they start their Final Fantasy VII summon, you need to cycle between all of your characters and hit defend or evade, whatever, put them in this defensive stance so that the boss like kind of gets a stun, or else you need to be super fast and super lucky to have an attack that's going that like will interrupt it, which is nigh impossible. So it just doesn't afford you the mobility to get around to your characters and do that and still be survivable. Cause basically if you make a mistake in that boss fight, you're hosed. You're either just sitting around recovering for the rest of the battle and like just kind of scraping by. You just can't really ever regain the momentum.
Going back to like what this battle system does right in terms of like the legacy that FF12 began is that like I feel like moving around the field has a big part. Like you can evade attacks by simply moving out of the way. If you're fast enough to get behind an enemy, then you are in the clear.
But you don't evade magic.
No, that's true. Because that just hones in on you. But if it's a big physical attack, you can get behind there.
That kind of reminds me actually of Secret of Mana. Because if you are skillful enough, you can usually evade physicals. But if the enemy uses magic, the whole screen pauses, and you take damage no matter where you are.
And vice versa.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I like that system. It, I don't know. I like it. I think it's pretty
cool. So addicting. I hadn't really read much about this game. I did not know it was a monster collecting game.
That's good.
And now that I know that, it's like too late. And I'm like, I've already gone down the rabbit hole. I try to get every single one pretty much. It's bad.
Interesting. Okay. I went the other direction where I was like, optimization 100%. I need the best team ever. So I spent a lot of time like working up these key characters that have the best stats and best like end game ability. Not that it mattered, you know, eventually, because I just turned down to easy and it's cakewalk.
Okay. I just use the ones that I like the way they look like. Like there's an owl. It looks so weak, but
fuck
I'm like,
owl,
it's an owl.
Puss on boats.
Dude, when I played the first Pokemon game, my team had Jigglypuff. Jigglypuff was like my man. Jigglypuff is like terrible in the first Pokemon.
Whatever. This game has the greatest character ever in any JRPG, and it is a cat. And the cat is a cut purse. And it eventually evolves into a cat called Puss on Boats.
Oh my god, I'm so excited.
And I caught one.
It's a pirate.
Oh my god.
I want it.
It is the greatest Pokemon to have in your party.
I am just as a desert in that game, so I'm really excited. I want to see the difficult boss battle, because I actually like difficulty in my RPGs a lot.
That desert is kind of like the testing grounds for it. Like there's a fiery boss fight in that area that kind of gives you that first taste of, oh shit, this may be harder than it actually appears.
Awesome.
And then the immediate boss battle after that, which is the one we're discussing, is really something.
Yeah.
It's something. Like, yeah.
I'm excited.
But that then cool. is also, like, it's a really good feeling to finish that, because that's when it's kind of like the game finally lets go of you and is like, okay, now you can have the X and do the things that you've are typically going to be doing once the world opens up in a JRPG.
12 hours in.
And Jamie, the airship music is the greatest music of this year.
Thank God there's an airship, because I am not going all the way back to like old towns to do these quests. It's insane.
Well, isn't there a warp?
There's a warp? If there is a warp, I don't have it yet.
No, dude, I even remember there's a spell that lets you warp places.
You may just not have it yet.
Huh.
Okay. I'm fairly certain there's a town warp.
Okay, well, if I should definitely look into that, because I've literally been walking. I did one quest where I walked back, and then after that I was like, screw it. I'm just not going to do the quest that have me going back and forth.
Yeah. I tried to do some sequence breaking and like just slide by really high-level enemies to get rare mats. Didn't really do anything. I made a new sword that didn't do shit.
I just discovered how to feed them, so I've just been feeding them, and it's like Tamagotchi all over again. It's amazing.
That game just has so many good parts to it. Like, just so many addicting JRPG qualities where you're like, there's the Tamagotchi feed your animals crap. There's the greatest, menu in the entire world. That fake book is the best thing ever.
Which you have to read Wizards for certain quests.
Yeah, you do. They force you to do it.
They force you to read whole stories. That's and then awesome. Type in... Okay, this is infuriating. You have to type in whole words on a crappy, not QWERTY keyboard.
Dude, you can turn it into a QWERTY keyboard.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn it. There are all these things that I didn't know.
Well, you mean, are you talking about the PS3? Not the worst part. It's
No, Jeff. It's not the PS3. It is an in-game...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
It is an in-game keyboard, and they ask you a riddle about a story. And you have to type in a multi-word answer, and you have to get it exactly character by character.
Case-sensitive, right? Yeah.
Case-sensitive.
Didn't they do that in Wind Waker as well?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know.
Griffin?
Oh, I didn't play Wind Waker.
Oh, that's right. You don't play console Zelda. They did. That's a bummer.
No, it's you know. The game does too many things right for anything to hold it back.
It does. But then it also has these handful of flaws that really bum me out about it, too. Like, I think I don't know if I told you guys this or where I said this, but I think if there was, like, a Tails-style skit system in it, I would love that game. It would be the greatest game of my life. Like, if it was you're running around and you press the select button and then all the three characters had a little talking bit of like, hey, this is the funny little thing that happened when we saw this withered dick tree in the desert.
Like, so basically FF9?
Well, I mean, kind of like Tails. Like, are you familiar with the skit system?
I am familiar. I know the Tails skit system. I like the FF9 one because it actually has, like, it puts you in the world.
Okay.
Or does the Tails ones just have talking heads, or does it have
the talking heads? But I like that more. Like, I find it more charming when it's just
really
like the way the images skitter around the screen as if they're, you know, to tell the story as to how people are. It's very anime.
Yes. See, I like the ones in Final Fantasy IX because, like, the characters. Whenever you've both played FF9, right?
Yes.
Unfortunately.
Okay. What? You monster!
I didn't like it.
Wow.
Anyway, when you go to a town in FF9, it's always like a big event, and when you walk in, like, all your characters split up and do their own thing, and you can hit the select button, actually, same button, and you can click on one of them, and your character will be, like, interacting with someone in the town. And, like, it'll be, like, a little conversation between, like, Vivi and another black mage, or, like, you know, I don't know, Freya and, like, a dude. And every town you go into, it's always, like, a little thing that happens. Like, you always split up, and you always have, like, little scenes you can watch, and they develop the characters. But they also, like, give you a sense of what the town is like.
Yeah, that's cool.
I like those.
That's awesome.
Yeah. The towns could use a little bit more fleshing out, too. I mean, every town is... Yeah, everything's fine. It's like, this is the resort town. It's,
yeah.
This is the...
Yeah.
Oh, God, Jamie, you haven't... there's so many good things in the game. I have a save file that I'm going to do a video of, which is a part of the game that you're edging closer to, which is just the most... flummoxing fucking JRPG thing ever. It goes full on El Shaddai, like,
really
in the best way possible. And I only say that because it means nothing to you guys, but it is exactly that.
Do you kill God?
What's that?
Do you kill God?
No, you go to a level that is just completely outside of anything you've experienced in the game so far.
Oh my God. Cool. I'm so excited. I love the little things it does that I miss in older RPGs, talking about like nostalgia and stuff like that. Like when you walk into a town, the camera pans up and it says the name of the town in a nice unique font for the town.
Same thing also was FF9, by the way.
Exactly. Same thing happens for bosses, which is great.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. But we need more of that.
We do. Yeah.
But
hey, right now there's Ni No Kuni, which came out this year, and it's a great game.
Yeah, and it's $20 on sale lots of places.
Yeah.
So
you're a fool to not have that game.
I gotta play that again.
It's so good. I don't know how it got its hooks into me so deep. I felt dirty playing it today.
Like why? This sixth hour.
I don't know. It was like I didn't even want to play anymore, but it was like, oh, man, got to get that Pokemon made out of bananas.
I had that same thing, dude. Like I'd fall asleep playing the game, wake up at midnight, and I'm like, ugh, just like wipe the goo off my face and be like, well, I probably should get back to playing Ni No Kuni.
See, I'm too jet lagged to play it. Like, I put it in my PS3 today, and I was like, maybe I'll play some Ni No Kuni. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so tired. I can't do it. It's too much.
It is a different game at 12 hours than it is at where you are, Jeff.
Absolutely.
Completely different game.
Yeah. It's like, it goes from like a Zelda style adventure to a full open world Final Fantasy RPG.
Wow. Yeah. It feels like they're. I almost feel overwhelmed with the amount of like side quests and things to do, like all the things that I can learn to craft, all the spells that I have.
That's kind of like a bummer sometimes, though.
It is a bummer, but luckily the game.
Jamie, just wait till you get stealing as an option.
I love stealing. Stealing is like my life.
Your life will be over.
The game does little things which really help. For example, when you get a hunt quest on the world map, it will highlight exactly where the thing you need to hunt is, so you don't go searching around. Mm-hmm. When you need to interact with NPCs, it highlights them on the map, so you don't need to talk to everyone in a town. You can just go to the highlighted NPCs.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to do, but it's It's streamlined in certain ways.
Okay.
That's so cool.
It's not trying to be artificially long in ways that JRPGs often tend to be. And that holds true too with like the open world map and how there's enemies that appear on it. Like hypothetically, you can dodge all of those guys if you are careful enough.
I don't remember. Is it one of those games where if you are really strong and you encounter an enemy, you just kill it outright?
No, but they run away from you.
They run away from you. That's right. That's right.
So you don't need to bother with them.
Yeah.
Okay. So if you're trekking back to do some quest or something, you don't need to fight anyone, which is nice.
Very nice. I just want to go listen to that flying music right now.
God damn it, Jeff. Griffin, what hour do you get the airship?
You are probably another 8 hours out from it.
If not, do you get something between?
You're moving really fast. Like if you're already at the genie at 12 hours, like you are
really
going really quickly. Yeah.
I've done almost all the side quests.
Cause you're about a third of the way through it. Like the next step is the dragon the pseudo boss fight thing that you have to do after the village. And then you have to do the final kind of like end chapter thing. You know what I mean? That last act of the JRPG.
Of disc four.
What's that?
Yeah. Disc four.
No, back to disc one.
I was going to say, what was I going to say? God, I don't even remember. Damn it.
Poop cruise. I literally think about that though, you guys. I think about that carnival cruise and I wonder like why was there poop everywhere? There's an ocean around you. Put the poop in the ocean. I don't get it.
All of their poop shovels were tragically broken.
Well, that's maybe something has to do with how exaggerated the media gets. You never see that ever at all, especially in the case of video game journalism when a game gets canceled because of a Twitter fight.
Oh, God.
That's a segue. You segue.
That was a beautiful one.
Yeah.
I'm glad we pointed that out. Thanks. Thank you.
I'm so sad. Yeah.
No, it's... Since this is a podcast, we need to comment about the segue.
Have you seen Indie Game, the movie? Of course you have.
Yes.
Great. It's great, obviously. And in that movie, you see how Phil Fish, creator of Fez, he is an emotional wreck.
Yeah.
He's definitely got some baggage. I wouldn't be surprised if he's like diagnosably something or other.
Well, he's admitted to being bipolar. And in that movie, everybody is a wreck. Nobody's happy in that film.
Yeah. Except John Blow,
who's just typing on his weird keyboard.
He's just like in total Zen mode the entire movie.
Yeah, exactly.
He's just like Indigo Prophecy guy.
He definitely seemed especially like really susceptible to all of the ups and downs of the business.
Yeah.
So I'm surprised he even announced Fez 2, to be honest, because I had thought after the first one he was like, no more. Can't do this anymore.
Well, I think that Fez 2, based on what he said in interviews, was going to be vastly different from Fez.
Yeah.
It was only Fez in that it was a game from the mind of Phil Fish.
Mm-hmm.
I really hope that he cools down and comes back, and I don't think that's a long shot for some reason. I mean, obviously, I have no evidence. I have no insight into
his
character.
There are people who know Phil Fish better than you or I who say that is possibly a likely thing to happen.
Yeah. I feel like people, like, when you do something that rash, unless you're ashamed or embarrassed, it's hard to stick your guns on that, because it was just like, okay, it's over.
Yeah. Like, maybe he'll learn from this.
Well, and then hopefully that just means that he will be able to distance himself from his Twitter persona. Like,
he can
continue to be a designer and then just step away from the PR side of it.
Exactly. Yeah. He should just delete Twitter and then just post on Polytron like once every 3 months.
Yeah.
No one would be moan that if he did it.
No.
Or just do interviews in real life with real people. Like, if you ever watch his stuff with Giant Bomb, he seems to have a lot of fun with those guys. I think he just needs to find the right kind of crew to interview him that aren't looking for headline bait.
I was going to say, because he really has a big thing. Like, I remember he gave an interview and he didn't like the editorial work that was done after the fact on the interview, because I guess either they asked him a question about maybe his feud with the guy who co-designed Fez with him or something like that, and he was like, "I'm never doing another interview again."
Mm.
So he definitely has trouble when things are not maybe they're outside of his control, or he feels like there's an image being created of him that isn't what he wants it to be.
Sure.
Yeah. So.
It does appear that way. But regardless, yeah. It sucks that Fez 2 is going through problems.
It does.
Have either of them apologized? No, right?
I don't think either of them need to apologize. I think people just need to chill the fuck out, essentially.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah.
Cliff Bleszinski wrote a letter. You guys see that?
No. What did he say?
He basically wrote a letter to Phil Fish saying, like, hey, ignore the haters, more or less. It was like, you know, this is like people are mean, people are bad. Please come back. Like, I really like your work.
So you're telling me that that Cliffy is now like the Dr. Phil of the games industry? Like, he
wishes he was, honestly.
He's just gonna go around and give sagely advice to everybody. Like, I could fix Resident Evil.
The funny thing is, he was talking about his first game or one of his first games, and it was like a platformer about a jackrabbit.
Talking about Jazz Jackrabbit.
Yes, have you played it?
You don't remember Jazz Jackrabbit?
Have you played it, Jamie?
Of course. I played it on PC.
Did you know that that was like his first game?
No. I had no idea.
He's been in the industry since he was like 16 years old.
Yeah,
I have Jazz Jackrabbit on a floppy chain. It's on a floppy. I bought it in a bin at CompUSA.
It's just weird because he's so identified with like ultra-violent games and Jazz Jackrabbit.
He had a gun.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. Right. I think so. Or something.
But, I mean, he wasn't like curb stomping locusts.
Imagine if you're 16, though, and that's the game you have to make where you're like, oh, it's just a friendly rabbit with a measuring ruler who jumps around and collects number puzzles. Like, yeah, of course your like rage erupts when you're given free license as to what you were like. Yeah, it's just dudes shooting other dudes in the mouth hole. Stomp their teeth out.
So war correction, I don't think Jazz had a gun, but he did have like a bandana or something.
He was pretty edgy for his time.
Oh no, he didn't have a gun. He had a gun, never mind. My bad.
Did he work on Quake, Cliff Bleszinski?
I don't know.
Don't know.
I don't think so.
Okay. No, he worked on Unreal Tournament, that's right.
Yes. That was his thing. Yes, because he was a part of Epic. Unreal.
Yes. Okay.
And so do we think that the games journalism people are going to continue to be crazy assholes? Is that never, ever going to change ever?
I don't think there's... I mean, you say what you want to, but... whatever. Go ahead.
What?
Go.
Yeah. I was asking.
I'll answer. I was going to say, I think there's going to be some people who are and some people who aren't.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And you just have to choose... you know, some people are clearly just getting off on it. Some people are doing it constructively, and you know, there's certain types of personalities.
They're what is it about this medium? Because if you go
it's
on
every
to...
medium though, it's everything, Jamie. Like it's everywhere.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it is. There's assholes in movie reviews. There's anime garbage. Like it's the same thing everywhere.
Well, anime, I wouldn't be surprised, but I don't know. I'm especially in the last couple of weeks, I've really been reading a lot of movie blogs, reading a lot of movie reviews, and people don't flame bait as much there. I don't know.
Oh,
at least not the,
you would
not
be
the
totally
things
surprised.
That I've been reading.
It might be Jamie, that because of the way the closeness of games, quote unquote, journalists to the industry, like they feel like they're part of like the process, so they kind of feel like they want to be rock stars because they're so close to the industry.
Mm.
This is just a guess.
Could be.
That's like the only tangible difference I can think of related to other mediums or other types of media, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So like movie reviewers, like, yeah, they go to screenings, but like they don't have the kind of tight relationship with the movie industry.
And just another area or a guess here would be the, you know, it's an older medium. Movies have been around for a longer time, which means there's also been more longevity to give higher echelons to reviewers of movie stuff. So it's like you have those, like, you know, you have that hierarchy. You have those, like, you know, those luminaries who are like the Ebert and those folks who are at that high level saying, like, basically like the untouchables of movie reviews who are just brilliant in what they're saying. And then you have, like, you know, your Sun Times folk or whatever, like, you know, people who are doing it professionally. And then you've got lower gradations. But in games journalism, it's mostly flat and then, like, sub. Like, you've got the people who do it, get paid to do it, and then people who just blog. And then, like, the Jeff Keighley's and, like, the N-Guy Crawls or whatever who just do commentary here and there.
It's an interesting what you said, Griffin and Jeff. What I'm thinking now, why there may be a slight difference is that, for example, when Ebert was still alive, actually, I think, like, just a year before he died or something, he was at Sundance and he was watching some film. I forget what it was. And there were a bunch of critics in the audience. And the movie ended and the director got on stage, started answering questions. And some of these younger critics were just, like, tearing the movie apart in ridiculous ways, ways that really wouldn't stand up to criticism. And then Ebert stood up and he, like, basically silenced everyone. And he, like, rejiggered the conversation. He was like, I don't know why we're here bashing this film. We should be here discussing why it works and what didn't work in it. And I feel like there maybe people like him, like, took the dialogue and refocused it in productive ways. I mean, and he's dead now, but I don't know. There's no one in the games industry like that who like steps in and who has that kind of authority.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's the thing.
Yeah. So, like, no one's really earned it with, like, a really, no one has, like, picked up an audience with, like, because they're known for, like, their criticism that's, you know, based on some
there's some outlets. I don't think it works in individuals. I think it's more like outlets. Like, you have, like, you know, Edge is known for something like that, or, you know, like, for example, Game Informer is constantly known for outing new information and new games. And, like, it's just, it's a different medium. Like, so much of video games initially comes from fun. How much fun is it? And movies weren't initially like, how much fun were you experiencing? On the fun factor from Wowzy to Yowza, how did you feel? Like, that was not the origin of films. Like, it was, you know, games kind of started with that, like very visceral level.
Or even if it was the origin of movies, it's not what they're about anymore.
Yeah, thank
you. The other thing I would say is blogs. Just blogs.
Yeah.
It's the fault of blogs.
Sure.
Anytime you have a blog, it's, like, going to be sensationalist.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. And it's a whole hell of a lot easier to hate than love.
Yeah. True that.
You don't risk anything when you say something sucks.
You know it's not going to suck? BioShock Infinite DLC.
Dude. I'm coming around to it. Why don't you talk a little bit about what that is, Jamie?
So there's three things. The first thing is out, and it's arena combat. I don't give a shit. I don't know what that is. I don't care. It's $5. It's basically a set of challenges that you can do on your own or with others. And there's, like, new tonics, I believe. And
don't
care at all.
Skip.
And then there's going to be two additional pieces after that that are connected. The first of which is you're going back to Rapture before it went to hell. You're going as Booker, and the reason you're going is because Elizabeth has asked you to go, or a character who looks like Elizabeth. The story details are pretty vague at this point. So you're going to be able to see Rapture before the fall with Infinite graphics, and I'm super pumped for that. It's going to be a lot of, like, ambiance. It's going to be a lot of scene setting. Super psyched. So that's the first part. That's going to come out, I think, relatively soon. Then there's the second half, which is also in Rapture, and it's a continuation of the first part of the story, but you're not playing as Booker anymore. You're playing as Elizabeth, and it's survival horror after Rapture's gone to hell. So completely different gameplay.
Did you
so
say
I'm really
you said episodic?
Well, there's going to be basically two episodes. There's like the first one where you play as Booker, and then the second one where you play as Elizabeth. And the first one is coming soon, I think.
And did you – sorry, I was away from the microphone. Did you mention that it the first one is supposed to be non-competitive, all dialogue-based?
What?
For real? Are you serious, dude?
I listened to an interview on Giant Bomb with Ken Levine talking to Alex Navarro, and he said the first episode of Tales – or what is it? Buried at Sea?
Something like that.
It's supposed to be primarily focused on dialogue, if not dialogue alone.
What I read, well, there's a different interview.
Okay.
I forget where it is. And yes, it's largely exploration. It's largely dialogue. It's largely getting the feel for Rapture before the fall. But I do believe, and I'll check on this. I do believe Ken Levine said that there is going to be some combat and it is going to be BioShock Infinite style combat, but in smaller quarters.
Yeah, I heard there are literally skyhooks, which is weird.
But
well,
but the second one's going to be completely different in terms of gameplay. The second one's going to be, I mean, Ken Levine has said like you're not Booker as Elizabeth. You can't take down all these guys, and it's going to be like more survival oriented. So I'm excited.
I'm more excited about that than I've been about any DLC this year so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty excited about it as well. I liked BioShock Infinite. I wasn't like blown away by it, but I enjoyed it. But if it's less of the combat, I'd be happy. So if it's more interaction, I'd be really happy because the combat really felt like a slog to me sometimes.
Yeah.
So
I love it that. In that interview I listened to, Ken Levine said that Alex asked him a couple of questions and he said, I don't want to make comments on that because that touches on some of the rapture and the BioShock fiction at large of like the Booker Elizabeth dichotomy, like how those two characters exist in their meta life. That is going to be featured prominently in this game. So
you're
like, okay, back on board. Like if it's going to be, if it's going to be more Lost level, like crazy pseudoscience bullshit, then yes, give me more of that.
You know, is this the longest period of time between a game's release and the DLC being announced for a season pass? Cause it is, it's been like
long.
6 months or more.
Well, yeah, probably. I mean, season passes are kind of a new thing, but I'm sure you can dig up some Guinness Book of World record of DLC being very far away.
Mm. Oh, also he said, someone asked him, I think Joystick has a long interview with him up about this stuff. And they asked him if the Lutesses will be making, another, I don't know, appearance in the DLC. And he seemed to be saying that they're not going to be in the first chunk, which is done, but he loves writing them. He loves working with them as actors, and he's going to try to put them into the second half.
Awesome.
I think. So,
they were one of my favorite parts of Internet.
Yeah.
So
I'm really pumped. I'm glad that he seems to, in the interview with Joystick. Yeah, it was Joystick now. And I believe it's also that interview where he talks about the combat and says there will be infinite style combat in the first chunk.
Okay.
In that interview, he doesn't seem to be in the, I don't know, for lack of a better term, like ivory tower that I thought he was, or I don't know what that he seems to be. I thought he was the kind of guy who was like totally zoned out to what was happening in gaming at large and also zoned out to criticisms of his stuff. But in that interview, he seemed to be very aware and he seemed to be reacting to
the Irrational Games has a podcast, which he is on quite often. And, it's hosted by Sean Elliott, of all people, if you remember that character, Jamie, from old One-Up days. So,
Is that Sean, baby?
No.
Okay.
Very different person. Sean Elliott is the host of that, and has had these really awesome stories about like his interactions with Ken Levine, just feeling like a complete fucking moron. And I think Sean Elliott is one of the most bizarrely articulate and eloquent game thinkers I've ever, you know, had the opportunity to read or listen to. So that is really cool. But their podcast is really good and well put together, and gives sheds a lot of light on kind of what the mentality is at Irrational Games.
Mm-hmm.
I think you would enjoy it.
So is he, according to those podcasts, does he have his ear to the ground, or is he just in his own world?
It's both. It's I think he does both, where it's like he knows what's happening in games around him, but he's also really driven and wants to tell the story he wants to tell. And he is flat out about saying certain things like, yeah, we're going to do this because, you know, it makes more sense to do it this way just for sheer marketing value. Like, I'm sorry, but, you know, I have other more important things that I want to focus on, and I will throw this one away and just say, okay, fine. Like, you can have that marketing department. Like, he's very candid about reasons why why certain decisions are made. And it's, I mean, gotcha. You may kind of hate him for not having the artistic backbone, but I think he really does. And he has the things that he wants to say and do and show in his medium.
Yeah.
I feel like more than anything, I really would like to have like a snapshot or a picture of like what the development of Infinite looked like, because it seems like it changed a lot throughout its development. And I feel like I think what made it difficult for me is a lot of what was kind of promised, it didn't really come through in the final product. Like, even like some of the preview stuff that they showed, like, they implied that there would be like certain choices, and those were just kind of taken out, and the game seemed to take a very different direction. So I'm wondering like how he was feeling during the process, and like what changed. I'm really curious about that. That's something I've wondered about I played it.
If you recall, when the project started, he was both developer, producer, writer. He was he was lead creator and writer. Like, he was doing the production management side of it, and then writing the entire script of the game too.
My God.
Through, he ended up, actually, I think 2/3 of the way through, he ended up having to back off the writing side or the producer. I forget which side he actually took a break from.
Didn't they bring in another studio to help them finish?
I don't know about that. If they brought in another entire studio, probably, since 2K is all really interrelated, but.
Yeah, I think they did. I'll have to look into it. But yeah, it definitely changed a lot, and, you know, it was different than what I was expecting it to be. So, anyway.
I like that Art Deco, though. I do like that Art Deco stuff.
Who the hell don't? I'm just excited to see Rapture before.
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
I was just saying that, like, I did play Bioshock 2. Like, I have replayed Bioshock 1. I love Rapture so much. And I, like, you couldn't tell me anything that would make me more excited about a Bioshock game than you're going to get to see Rapture before everything went to crap. Like, that is just the epitome of awesomeness to me.
Is it going to be even more racist?
Probably. Maybe he got that out of his system with Infinite. I don't know.
God.
Maybe not. I don't know.
Bioshock, now with more black jokes.
He definitely doesn't handle themes with subtlety, which I think is fine in this medium especially.
Yeah.
But now that it's interesting. So Infinite comes out, right? And everyone's like, wow, this is so heavy-handed. And I completely agree, but what video games aren't? And then Last of Us comes out, and now I'm thinking maybe video games can, you know, engage with themes in a subtle, nuanced way.
Sure. For me, Bioshock and Last of Us are like Act 1 and 2. Yeah. They are like I view them as one entity when I am looking at like the games of 2013. Mm-hmm. Because of what you said, Jamie.
Yeah.
So it is funny though, and kind of unfortunate for them that Last of Us came out like right afterwards, as if to make the point.
You could have done this more, you know, delicately.
Yes.
But I don't know. I don't know if maybe we'll look back and we'll say that no, this game succeeds. It's not subtle. It's not, you know, it is heavy-handed, but that's what it is. I don't know.
Hopefully. I guess I don't think that in Infinite is that heavy-handed. I mean, I guess relatively too, comparing it to other games. I mean, I think that I don't really, if you're saying like the racism bit and stuff like that is too blatant, I don't really get it.
More like one thing that immediately comes to mind for me is when they build up like how not so much the racism itself, but like when they're building up like how horribly the blacks in that in Colombia are treated.
Yeah.
And then you hear all these audio logs and it's like, oh my God, you know, I forget the guy's name even now. Comstock is such an asshole, you know, he's such this horrible ruler. He's really terrible to these people. And then like you snap your fingers, you go through Time Rift, and then suddenly the oppressors are the black people. And then Booker is like, I guess the only difference between Comstock and Fitzroy is how you spell their name.
Yeah, exactly. It's one liners like that that make it a little like it's like you're not actually going to engage with this topic. You're just going to throw out a one liner and then that's the end of it.
Yeah.
Or just hit us over the head with that idea, which is not a new idea. Like when, you know, the trope of people fighting for power, getting it, and then turning out to be awful has been outplayed since A Tale of Two Cities. So it's like, so I think that's what people are responding to, Griffin, when they say it's a little heavy-handed. But I don't think that's a bad thing necessarily. And sure. I also think that Bioshock 2, 1 and 2 were also heavy-handed. Uh-huh. Like if you replay 1 and you go down the elevator into the city, as you go down, they play a little video for you,
yeah.
And it's just like he like stuck a needle into Atlas Shrugged and like extracted the objectivism, and then like inserts it into you in like literally a minute and a half.
Yeah,
and it's not like that's built up deftly over the course of the game. Again, not necessarily a criticism. Mm-hmm. Just it's an info dump, right? It's what you try to avoid in science fiction. You don't want an info dump.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's kind of what Bioshock did both so well and so poorly, is having the info dump, which is the audio log, which
yes.
is mm-hmm. a carryover from System Shock. And then, you know, finally having it here in Infinite. He admits to saying, like, yeah, of course, like, we're going to have something that still remains marketable and makes sense to keep around. But then mm-hmm. it doesn't fit really in the grand story he's trying to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. But the info, I have such mixed feelings about the info log, because it does, at least to me, it does make sense. Like, you know, you're moving around, you want to explore, yes. and at the same yes. time, you get this nice yeah. little thing going on in the
every
background.
Every game should
so.
Have, I don't, yeah, every game should have them. But
yeah.
then no game should have them. Well,
yeah, it's kind of like the code of conversations in Metal Gear. It's like you recognize how absurd and how narrative breaking they can be, but also, like, if the game just feels barren.
Yeah, well, I mean, Rising Revengeance, I felt this was the perfect time to bring this out for discussion, because even the overlay for these codec conversations was happening, like, when you were still doing the finger up to the ear walk around. So, hypothetically, you could still be engaging in combat while these two, like, you know, ghostly faces were yelling words at you that you didn't really give a shit about. But they went back to the old classic method of, like, okay, you either can't move at all and you're pigeonholed into the section where you just need to listen to these people talk, or you literally have to go dig into menus to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, Metal Gear, you could say that that is part of what makes a Metal Gear game. But I think once they got so close to stepping away from that, I really wanted them to go all the way and have audio, quote-unquote, audio logs that were happening during gameplay.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Well, the best, of course, would be delivering as much story as you can through the environment. So,
yes.
like, you go in a room and maybe there's like a note or something, but you don't even need that much.
Sure, like Half-Life would do.
Yeah.
sometimes, like, I want more. And I think in those cases, I think what Mass Effect did is good, where it's literally just a compendium at your disposal. And if you want, if you really want to delve into, like, what makes a certain species of alien unique, then you can go and, like, read or listen to your heart's content. Yeah. And if you don't want to, you don't need to.
Yeah, I think in-game encyclopedias hurt no one.
Yeah. Especially when they're voice acted by the guy who does audio clips for the Science Center.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. I'm kind of remembering that now.
Go to your local Science Center.
You guys probably talked about this in The Last of Us, but when he picks up the things at the end and you literally just have to stare at the tape recorder, even if there's action going on around you, that's a little game-breaking to me.
Yes, when they brought the audio logs into Last of Us.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
And then you play the thing. Like, I played one, and there was, like, a guy, like, stalking me. But I just sat there and listened while someone was trying to...
I didn't have a problem with it. I thought it was totally fine. I actually kind of liked it.
Oh, no, like, I liked it, too. This isn't really a criticism. It's just a, you know, another example of this.
There were a lot of quirky little bits in the end of that game, which we kind of touched on. It's like slightly different elements, like the guys, the double headshot guys for one, the audio logs as opposed to handwritten notes. But yeah, for the most part, I think The Last of Us, for me, they kind of did it right. Like, you go in a room and, like, you can gather a lot of what happened by looking at the shit strewn around the room.
Yeah.
Which is a good way to, and then there's like a note, like, you know, it's like a page at most.
Right. And usually the note doesn't have anything to do with anything anyway. It's just like, grocery list for this week.
Mm-hmm. Love that shit.
Love it.
Read a million grocery lists.
Pounds of people meat. How many did you get this week? Loved it. I don't mind spongy enemies. It's a video game.
Yep. I don't mind either.
That's my personal little thing there. I get how for some it could be game or immersion breaking, but you know, whatever.
Yeah, I didn't mind because I used the flamethrower there and it killed them anyway in one shot. I do think it was weird because they went so long without having double headshot enemies. Like,
and then at the end
they have helmets popping off and I'm like, am I playing Uncharted? It's a little weird.
By the way, I really had a hankering for Uncharted, so I went through my library and I and determined that at some point I must have sold Uncharted 2, which is the stupidest thing I've ever done.
So
I went and bought another one.
Well, that's
and I'm playing it again. I played a little bit, and it's aged, but it hasn't, not for the worse. It's still amazing.
Interesting.
Still the best have Uncharted.
Yeah, by far still the best Uncharted.
Why was Uncharted 3 so bad?
I don't know. The story in 2 is, like, just so deftly implemented. Like, I don't know if you guys remember or if you've played it since 2009, but in the beginning of the game, you travel a little bit, like you're wounded, so you make your way up the cliffside a little bit, and then you kind of pass out.
Yep.
And then you have, like, some cutscenes and some flashbacks, and then it goes back to you making your way up the cliffside, and all of a sudden 3 hours have gone by and you feel like it's been 15 minutes. It's just so, it's like, when would you stop? It's like, I need to know more. So good.
Amazing game.
Have you guys played it since 2009?
Nope.
I have not either.
Maybe,
but I remember exactly what you're talking about, Jamie.
Maybe 2010 on, like, New Year's Day when I was hungover as hell. I think I played the game all the way through from start to finish. I was like, I just want to play Uncharted and feel better. Fucking Tank. Fuck you, Tank.
Is that the one with the Sintamani Stone? The Sintamani Stone.
Sure.
Maybe.
There's I just remember him saying that repeatedly.
That's the one with the dude from Crossing Jordan.
That is a blast from the past.
And when I was playing it, I remembered things about that game that in 2009 blew me away, but now they're just hilarious. Like when Drake goes into a pool of water and comes out and his clothes are all shiny.
Yeah.
But now he just looks like he's made out of glass temporarily. But in 2009, it was like, whoa!
So here's my just quick reason as to why I think Uncharted 2 is better than Uncharted 3. And that is because I think Uncharted 2, or I think Uncharted 3 is too reliant on set piece moments, whereas Uncharted 2 is a smoother game. Now, however, critically, you may look at that and say there aren't as many big defining moments that make the whole thing as memorable as 3. However, as an overall story, it tends to mesh better and is more interesting adventure than 3, which just seems like big staccato moment to staccato moment.
Excitement.
3 is like, it's like they took the mindless action movie thing from Hollywood and applied it. And they also just like, they tried to have an interesting narrative, but they just like, they started to have these interesting things. Like maybe like you're not even descended from Drake at all. And like, you're kind of an asshole. I can't remember exactly what it was. And then they just like, they had all these plot threads that they started, which sounded cool. And then the ending was just like a total letdown. It was like, oh, well, Drake goes and reconciles with that lady who I can't remember her name.
Yeah.
And it was just like so weak.
It had a couple of really cool moments, like of really just good movie moments of like Drake coming into the room and like laying down on Ellie and no words being spoken. But then that's immediately followed up by the goddamn worst boat fucking fighting in the water sequence in the entire world. And you're like, oh my God, this ship is so huge. It's making me want to puke because it's a big boat. And then, you know, then you go to the underwater ship thing and it's like, oh, this battle sucks a bunch of nutsacks because it is impossible to play this because there's dudes coming in from everywhere. Like,
also, the fucking miniguns were the worst in that game.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Uncharted 1 had better turret sequences.
But yeah, you're right, Griffin. They totally just went from set piece to set piece. I think I read somewhere that that game was designed around its set pieces and the second game was less designed around
it. It would make sense. It felt very Call of Duty.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. I just remember the tone. I didn't like the tone of the game. Drake was way too severe. He wasn't wisecracking as much. There wasn't as much points where they were just banter between the characters. Like, there were so many moments when I would just be pushing a car around or doing something boring and nothing would be happening. Mm. And I was thinking to myself, if this were Uncharted 2, right now they'd be wisecracking. Something.
I think part of it also literally... it also suffers from the Mass Effect syndrome, or as I like to call it, not Ocean's 11. And that's your team is already put together, and what is the conflict that happens after you've already collected your team? Well, it's surely not as interesting as getting the team together.
Yes.
So Uncharted 2 kind of had that fun bit of like, okay, now we got to rescue Sully and we got to get the girl. And we've got this traitor who's kind of on our team, but not. And then in the end, everybody's working together, and we pull off the biggest heist of the century.
You saying that makes me want to play the game literally right now. Just leave the podcast.
I know.
Play the game.
You definitely sold it.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Yeah.
You want to go through those little ice caverns moments.
And shoot those wildebeest men.
ice caverns had two of them, like the one of the more charming moments in the game and one of the more infuriating moments, and the charming moment was the guy who doesn't speak English,
Tenzin.
And the infuriating moment was the Yeti.
I was gonna say the entire fucking ice caverns was just the worst puzzle jumping around shit that ended up like, if you could cheese your way over one of those spinning cogs and not have to actually do most of that dungeon, it was a much better experience.
But Tenzin was awesome.
He was. He had that whip.
He did.
Wasn't afraid to die.
I think there was a bit greater stress. I mean, it definitely wasn't super heavy on the stealth, but there is more stealth in Uncharted 2. And in the beginning, the first time where you are actually like fighting enemies, really, is you're in a museum, and if you get caught, the game just ends.
And it makes wailing tube noise, like you take that you take the bendy straw and you swing it around your head really fast, it makes that beginning of Lost noise. It's like, oh God.
I didn't really like that though. And I also noticed that in 2, one thing that I didn't like mechanically about 2 is that if you break stealth in 2, then it's just over, forget it. There is no going back.
Yeah,
like you cannot
fun with too.
Well, thank God they fixed that for The Last of Us.
Yes, they did. They also started to fix it in 3.
Well, speaking of fixing things on the PlayStation, Jeff, you want to talk a little bit about RAMgate?
Sure. I guess it was recently revealed that the PlayStation 4 has set aside 3.5 gigs of its RAM, of its 8 gigabytes of RAM for OS functions.
You lied to me.
Yeah, which means that only 4.5 gigs of RAM are going to be available for developers, which means that John Blow is not going to be able to make The Witness because of his using 5 gigs of RAM, which means that the next gen is going to be canceled. And apparently, I guess Microsoft only sets aside 3 gigabytes of RAM of its OS, or for running its OS. So,
oh my God.
I guess Sony is going out of business, or I don't know. Something's happening.
512 megs.
I wrote in there Team Garlic Xbox. Or Team Onion. I forget which one it was.
Team Onion.
Are you familiar with where that came from?
I have no idea. No.
Oh, okay. So I don't. This is where my ability to know about technological stuff, you know, smacks against the wall of my own brain limits. And I read an article on a similar thing about the PlayStation RAM and the allocation of how the thingies work inside, and there were 3 thingies, and these 3 thingies are bunched together as 2-in-1 and 1 by itself, and they have different RAM allocations, and one has like 10 and the other one has like 1, which already doesn't make any sense to me because those numbers don't exist in the PlayStation architecture.
What are you talking about?
Whatever, just stick with
happening?
Me. Stick
I'm
with
so
me.
Tired.
So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the specs are. It only matters that. Okay, so the gist of this thing that I read a while ago before what you wrote about RAMgate was that it is a very malleable architecture, and like resources can be allocated in either direction very, very easily.
Flex RAM.
Yes. Yes. More than that, though, like this is not necessarily just related to RAM. It may just be on processor stuff too. But this is what makes it so funny: is they nicknamed these 2 different outlets "Onion and Garlic."
That's amazing,
and it's fucking amazing that they name both their like bus ports, like their processor areas, "Onion and Garlic." So I believe in the power of the PlayStation 4. And I am on Team Onion, Team Garlic.
I want to be on Team Garlic. I like garlic way better.
You're not Team Onion?
I'm Team Garlic.
Yeah, Team Garlic.
You would be, you Wario heads.
I thought you were referencing a short-lived NeoGAF thing where they thought that the guy who was posing as Joachim Mogrum, or whatever the hell his name was CGI. Do you remember this?
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Team Real and Team CGI?
Yes. What? No, this is realer than that. Realer than that.
Okay, realer than Team Real.
Yeah.
I think it doesn't matter at all. I just thought it was really funny that people were getting really upset about 512 megabytes of RAM, although that is an entire Xbox 360's worth of RAM.
Yeah.
But the fact remains that it's either 9 times or 10 times the amount of RAM of the current generation that mm-hmm. these consoles are going to have access to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it makes no difference. Just think it's
none whatsoever.
But yeah.
I mean, what? If that much is allocated to the OS, then maybe fucking PlayStation Network won't run like hot trash anymore.
Exactly. Because that is a big operating system. That is bigger than like Windows 8.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it has to do all sorts of stuff. It has to like record you playing games and then keep that stored and have that ready to send out. So if that's going on, then I kind of knew when they said that you'd be taking a chunk out of what the games maybe could be capable of. But at the same time, that's a lot of RAM.
Yeah, I expected 2 at the most, honestly, from both parties. And getting 3 and 3.5 is – I was pretty surprised by that, to be honest. It's like a lot. I guess they want a future-proof so they can just throw whatever shit they want in there and not have to worry about like a PlayStation store that takes like 3 minutes to load.
Just want to watch my G.I. Joe.
Wasn't there some whole thing that happened with the Xbox because they didn't allocate enough RAM to their OS? So certain third-party apps or something run really slow.
I don't know.
I don't know. Anyway, yeah.
That would sound totally Microsoft-y, though.
Yeah.
Microsoft-y.
Whoa. Speaking of Microsoft, and this is the thing that I think is more important on the new console front, Microsoft has revealed self-publishing for indies.
Yes. So relating back to the whole Phil Fish thing last
Phil
week.
Phil Fish has withdrawn from the limelight just to publish his title on Xbox One exclusively. Yep. Fez 2 is being re-released or re-announced for Xbox One.
Yeah. Also so anyway, being taken down from every other service.
Yes. So, yeah, so they announced self-publishing. I guess it was leaked early. But apparently any console can be used as a dev kit, which is pretty interesting to
me. Okay,
well,
just to rewind here for a second. None of this has been, like, officially stated by Microsoft proper, right? This is Larry Herb, Master Nelson side channels and reporting of things people have been told, like Gamescom is supposed to be when all this gets officially trotted out for realsies.
I'm going to tell you right now. I think there was an interview where they actually confirmed it.
I think they said that self-publishing will now be a new focus, that they want to focus on indie developers and afford self-publishing for people, but none of the details are available yet.
Okay, so they have confirmed it. Hold on.
More at 11.
Yeah. They also confirmed that the console will double as a dev kit. Mark Witten said to Engadget. Yeah, so they have confirmed it.
Okay.
Because I checked before.
But there are hazy details around that too. Like, what does that mean?
There are always hazy details.
Like, sure, you can hack it to be a dev kit.
Well, here's what's hazy. So Mark Witten said, our vision is that every person can be a creator, that every Xbox One can be used for development. So it's our vision. Is it our reality? I don't know.
Yeah.
But I would assume so. I mean, it certainly seems like it's not outside the realm of possibility. Because wasn't the Xbox 360, didn't it have some kind of thing going on where for one of their many sub-services, you could use Xbox 360s as dev kits for like XBLA?
I don't think so. I think you had to develop on a computer, I thought.
Okay, maybe I'm wrong.
Using the Windows...
The XNA or whatever.
Yeah, there you go, XLNA
or whatever. Yeah. Yeah, okay, that must be what I'm thinking. But yeah, it's been more or less confirmed. I mean, you know, they say more details in August, but they have affirmed, at least, that their vision is that every console could be a dev kit.
Sure.
And I guess my question would be, first of all, is this a game changer? Does this... put both of these guys basically, you know, Sony and Microsoft, are they basically back on equal footing now? You know, is the PR advantage still with Sony? I mean, where do you guys think this puts things right now? Would be my question.
You go first, Griff.
I think that PR-wise, Sony is still in the lead. I think that when you ask anybody on the street, they will say, this is from anecdotal stuff. Oh, that Xbox, that one that hates the consumer, you can't even play use games on it. Like, people still haven't even got past that hump.
Uh-huh.
And I think that kind of consumer also doesn't give a shit about indie self-publishing. So that's falling upon kind of like a deaf ears. I think that it's great for those of us who care, because it does put consoles back on even footing. And for people like the three of us and people who are listening, it's totally rad because we win. Like, now we get indie games everywhere.
That's true.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with it, but I think this saves face for the device in the long run. But right now, in winning this current battle, I think they're still in a losing position.
Yeah. So I agree with Griff. Last week we talked a little bit about how I went to a GameStop and the guy told me that they had about 60 pre-orders for PS4 and about 30 for Xbox One.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
subsequently, I went to two other GameStops, and one said pretty much exactly the same thing, and another one said that they actually had 60 pre-orders for PS4 and like 10 for Xbox One.
Wow.
And I asked them both at both of those places, like, why that is, and it's exactly what Griff said. They said that people still think that you're not going to be able to play used games.
Play used games, yeah.
On the Xbox.
Do you guys think there's anything that Microsoft could do to turn things around? Like, what? Let's say they come out in game, because there was a rumor that was going around that's basically been shown to be false. But let's say they came out at Gamescom. They're like, hey guys, $400. Mm-hmm. Would that put them back on equal footing again?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, I think so too. I just wanted to check with you guys and see what you thought.
I think Microsoft comes out and says, because honestly, I think that they have the more marketable product. Mm-hmm. I just think that they have enough. There's enough bad branding around the Microsoft name, and then the Xbox One launch didn't sit well with the evangelists, so you didn't get that positive press that needed to push that device into like the population's good graces. Mm-hmm. So I think what they need to do now is just kind of do a mea culpa and like say, hey, this is the new Xbox, like for the people, for you, for gamers, and then just kind of like do a hard reset, like bring out Velocity Girl, take Jay Allard out of cold storage and throw him up on stage and, you know, kind of get back to those Xbox roots and kind of distance themselves from Microsoft.
Bring out Julie Larson Green.
Yeah. I honestly don't believe that they would ever do anything like that, because I feel like they are that is not their vision for this console anymore. Their vision is to become the one thing that you use in the living room, which is completely ridiculous and not ever going to happen. But I feel like that's what they're shooting for.
I think they can do it though if they just but they're not getting the box into the house the right way. Mm. You need to Trojan horse it. You can't just sell it as the all-in-one, you know, Swiss Army knife device, because not everybody wants a Swiss Army knife. They're weird and nerdy. You want like the nerds to buy them and then tell them about like why everybody needs to buy their parents an Apple TV. Like, you need to get them into the right people and then have them disseminate that.
Yeah, I agree. I was gonna say I think that Jesus, I'm so tired tonight. I just lost the thread again. You go. Someone else can jump in.
And I'm pretty tired too, and I also have to be quiet because my dad's yelling at me.
I was gonna say, you sound a lot more sensual now.
I like it.
This is my sexy. This is how I tell patients they're gonna die. I think that they have lost, honestly, because I didn't think so before. I thought that. What you said, Griffin, a couple weeks ago is correct, that this thing ebbs and flows and the public opinion on this stuff is going to change like overnight. But it hasn't. And people still have the same misconceptions. And I feel like they made a huge they stumbled in a huge way. And I don't know what they have to do to get people thinking about them
They need to
the right
play. They need to show the games. They need to show
it's
the
all
games.
About the games.
Well, it is, because I mean, if that is one thing that kept Sony alive, that is having that like Japanese niche of like,
yeah,
hey, you people who liked our products before, well, just hold out, because we'll take care of you and give you your weird Japanese crap as time goes on. Like,
and
Microsoft uses that same pitch as like, hey, we took care of you gamers before. You want your Call of Duties, your Forzas, your action, you're awesome. And frankly, like your indie stuff, we did it first and we did it best. Like, I think they have the money and I think they have the smarts to do it again. It's just, can they swing that into the public's perception?
Yeah, and I remembered what I was going to say. I was also going to say, don't count out their ability to backtrack just yet, because they have been backtracking up a storm.
Yeah,
like far more than I've ever seen Microsoft backtrack. Like, I guess you could say it started with adding the start button back into Windows. They seem to have been, they seem to have put themselves, like, they got on their high horse with all of their different departments. Like, they're like, users don't need a start button, you know, users don't need used games, whatever. And in each of their respective departments, they were like, okay, we know what you want better than you know what you want.
Sure.
And it seems like they are moving as fast as they possibly can to about face on all this stuff. And I would not, I would wait until, I would say Gamescom is their last kind of, their last great hope for turning things around. I don't think there's much they can do between then, unless they schedule some big event.
I don't even think Gamescom is going to be that big of like a thing, because it's like, you know, they would be better off scheduling their own event, because
I guess so.
Who in the public, like if you go to average person on the street and you say, hey, do you know what E3 is? Like, you may get like a 1 in 5 person saying, oh, that's that video games thing, right? That's like the Comic Cons. And if you say, do you know what Gamescom is? Somebody's like, is that was that old Commodore system? Like, you, no one knows what Gamescom is. Not even
I just figured that Gamescom is like the time when you've got Microsoft and Sony in the same general space. You know, that's the time when people are going to be looking at them again, like, hey, these two companies are competing with each other. So if Microsoft is like, hey, guess what? We cost $400 and, you know, I don't know, Halo. Here's some Halo or something. I don't know, whatever. Then that's like their time to be like, look at us. Look at the competition. Look at this new thing that we've, you know, about faced on. Or look at this new thing that we've added, some new value proposition. That would be their, I think, to me, that looks like their last stand. Like, they could have another event afterwards, but I'm not sure it would have the same impact.
Do you think that if they did do that, then Gamescom would have a gajillion times more reputation than it's ever had before?
I don't think people would remember the event as much as they would remember the facing off of two rivals.
You don't think that, like, next year it's going to be like, well, now, two mega corporations go into the ring, only one leaves at Gamescom.
Gamescom is a Vita event. Gamescom is going to go down in history as the event where Vita was redeemed.
Whatever, man. This could just be another Sony head fake, and, like, now they're like, nope, no Vita stuff here. All PlayStation 4 stuff that we weren't talking about again.
You don't understand, Griffin. That's what I was implying. They have said that every single event is going to be a Vita event, and they have gone on the record saying that Gamescom is going to be a Vita event.
We're going to let the Xbox go first. We'll let Microsoft go first, and then they're like, nope, secret press event here at the end of January.
Yeah. They're clever.
Clever girls. Is there anything else on that Google Doc we got to talk about? Because I don't have it open.
Yes. I also noticed that, first of all, Nintendo just released their quarterly reports, like, today. And this goes hand in hand with something else that I wrote down. So first of all, I'll talk about their quarterly reports. So
Wait. Back it up here for a sec. So speaking of companies in the shitter.
Whoa. Now do I go?
Yeah. All right. Sorry.
So anyway, Nintendo, not in the shitter actually, although the Wii U is. So they had their quarterly report, and I believe they brought in a lot of revenue. I will check. But most of it came from the 3DS. Like, Animal Crossing has sold 5 million copies. Their year-over-year revenue is down, I think, but not by much, and I think it's still a profit for the quarter. But the big news is that the Wii U, between April and June, sold 160,000 copies.
Boom, which is like abysmal.
Yeah. It's less than half the number of units sold between January and March. So the Wii U is selling abysmally. To kind of go hand-in-hand with this news, ASDA, or ASDA, a major UK retailer, has stopped stocking the Wii U on store shelves. So this is kind of adding more fuel to the fire, or more whatever, to the idea that the Wii U is, like, dying and it's on the way out. And I'm wondering, Do you guys think it's dead? Do you think there's any way it can come back? Do you think it's going to limp along like the GameCube? Is there going to be like a $100 price cut? Like, what the hell are they going to do with that thing? And why are Nintendo so crazy?
All right, I'm willing to let's do some wagering right here, right now. Like, okay. let's put our money on the measuring stick. Is what they say, right?
What are we going to do with that measuring stick?
Measure the money. So here's my hypothetical. Here's my prediction. So the Wii U, you know that device. I think that it is going to sell poorly this holiday season, and then in order to resurrect it, it will get a $100 price cut.
After the holidays.
So after the American holidays of the Christmas time.
Okay.
So 2014, it will receive a price cut after Pikmin does not sell shit. And yep. I don't know, what's the other big one in the horizon?
Game and Wario.
No. Fuck you, Mario Kart. I think that Mario Kart is going to sell abysmally as well. This is my risky endeavor. Is I think that Mario Kart is going to sell poorly. I think that Wii U will sell poorly, and I think because of that, the price will go down. But then I think that price cut will be what it needs, and that by that time there'll be enough third party things to kind of just keep it coasting until whatever next thing comes out. Oh.
Yeah.
There he
He's
is.
Back.
Yeah, sorry.
He's back.
That was a phone call.
Keep it coasting.
Yeah. Keep it coasting until something, I mean, just essentially until whatever next device there is.
So you can still ride it out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it'll be ridden out.
I agree.
You have to pick something different.
Well, I am, but it's never going to be amazing. It's never going to be the Wii in terms of sales, but it's going to coast until the next generation. But the only thing I disagree with you, or the only prediction that I have that's different, is that I think they're going to lower the price in like October or November.
Mm. Okay. Oh my gosh. Stop.
But it's not going to save it. That's my only difference.
I wonder how much they're going to lower the price. Are they just going to lop off like $100?
I hope so.
I hope so too. I want Nintendo to keep making consoles.
Yeah, me too.
They're so weird.
I feel like they've committed. They've
kind of in the way that only Nintendo can,
exactly.
Which is like not really.
Yeah.
Would you be saddened to see them go only handheld?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yeah. I guess.
Hey,
I would.
Hold on just a second. All right, you guys keep talking.
Okay. Go ahead, Jamie. Maybe you would be saddened.
Well, I feel like what they do doesn't need the kind of graphical power that
I guess
you get.
That's true.
From home consoles, so I feel like they could potentially be just as good as they are on handhelds. You know, I feel like they could exist and have all the magic, but you would just have it on your handhelds. So what do you think about that?
You know, that's actually interesting because they've recently have been undergoing a reorganization and they've been working on merging their handheld and console divisions into one division. And that might hint at like what they're going to do in the future. Like maybe their next move, seeing how abysmally the Wii U sold, is to make a handheld that you can hook up to your TV with
like the
a dongle.
The NVIDIA Shield, you just do an HDMI out.
Yeah, but like, you know, knowing Nintendo, I don't think they'd want you to hook a wire from your handheld to the back of your TV because that's
okay.
Like a Chromecast or something, like some kind of dongle or something. Like maybe that's what their next move is. Maybe they, because it is they're in this kind of weird place. Like why they put out like four Mario games in the last 2 years, like two new Super Mario Brothers platformers and two new Super Mario Lands. You know, So I don't know. That's an interesting theory. Hold on a second. Sorry, just had to cough there on my.
No worries.
But yeah, I guess if it didn't lead to them killing off, like if Mario Galaxy, if like a game like that could still exist on a handheld, then I'd be okay with it, I guess.
Maybe not this generation's handheld, but next generation's handheld. I mean, yeah. Of course.
Yeah, I feel like I guess I could live with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, they made a statement when they put out the Wii U with the hardware that it has, which is that that's not our jam. We don't care about having DX11 shaders. We want you to enjoy Mario for the same reason you've always enjoyed Mario, which is that it's Mario.
Yeah.
And you can't get that anywhere else.
I don't care about it either, but I want that console to do well. I like the tablet. I think it's cool.
I think it's cool too.
And Earthbound on my TV screen and on my tablet screen.
But wouldn't it be great if you could play Earthbound both on your TV screen, tablet, and your other, you know, your portable device? Like, wouldn't that be just great if they could get with the times and make a thing that you could play everything on, like a cloud based service?
No, you need
virtual console stuff on.
You need to buy Mega Man on the 3DS, the Wii, and the Wii U.
But I already have all the cartridges of them.
You shut your mouth.
But I already have all of them.
Listen, we will give you Mega Man on the Wii U if you pay a $2 premium.
Okay, well, that sounds reasonable. I'll go with that. That there doesn't seem anything wrong there.
I just got a 25-foot HDMI cable and a wireless keyboard, so I'm going to be playing some of my emulators on the big screen. I'm super excited about that.
Other three.
Emulators, you say.
Guess how much my 25-foot HDMI cable was.
I know.
$7.
I was going to say, hopefully sub $10.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Does the signal degrade at that point, at that length?
Absolutely not.
Nope.
No.
And the funny thing is, so I have my wireless keyboard. It's like a wireless keyboard and trackpad combo, so it just sits on your lap on the couch. Uh-huh. Like you have mouse and keyboard, but you don't need to have an actual mouse. And so I have that going wirelessly back to my tower, which is like 25 feet away. And then I have that going back through the 25-foot HDMI cable. And in game mode, I was playing Shadowrun on the TV. There's like no difference.
Cool.
Shadowrun isn't like a twitchy game, but I didn't feel any difference whatsoever. So I'll definitely be playing more stuff that way. It's awesome.
You should play Shadowrun for the Super Nintendo. I will hook you up with my cartridge, which you can then rip a ROM from.
Did you buy it, Jeff? Did you buy Shadowrun Returns?
Not yet, no.
Are you going to buy it?
You guys should talk about what makes it good.
I've got a copy here if you would like it.
Of Shadowrun Returns?
Yeah.
Hello?
Hello.
Oh, yeah, totally. Yeah, I'd love it. I mean, I don't want to take it from you.
Well, I was just going to put it on Twitter or something otherwise, so it's all yours.
Yeah, sure. Definitely.
Sold. Yes. To the highest bidder.
Griffin, you're amazing.
It's an awesome game, and I feel like I read a review, I think it was the Destructoid review, that said the single-player campaign is good. It's a good game, but what makes this really cool is like what the community is going to do with the level builder and all that jazz.
I love the tools. So.
And I think that's very true. Yeah. I am having a ton of fun with the single-player, and I just can't wait to see what people put out there. I think it's so well-written. It's so odd, and it's such a pleasure to just read the text instead of having it read to you by an actor. It's such a pleasure to just read well-written text again. Yep. It's like I completely forgot that was a thing.
I'm glad you like that, because I oftentimes, when I play modern games, I greatly miss just reading.
Yeah, and you read a lot. There's a lot of text. There's a lot of character development.
Yeah, even if it wasn't reading,
it's really nice.
Like if it was spoken dialogue, but everything that there is there is good. It's just I like more so than the reading part of it, Jamie. I think that the fact that they didn't give you like flat out like World of Warcraft style track your location that you need to go to next with this blip on the map and this route to go there. Like you need to kind of figure it out yourself and hunt and peck and do that searching. And the reading is crucial for it.
That's awesome.
It feels older, but in a way that I've been sorely missing. Like this graphical style, the isometric painted thing, we haven't had that in so long. We've had so much indie stuff doing the 8-bit thing. No one's done this in forever. it's so cool looking, and it's such a breath of fresh air. And like, I think they took a really interesting battle system and worked it in as well. The battle system is really fun.
Ooh, it's XCOM. Like, which is a good thing.
Yeah, it's cover based, like, you know,
turn based cover based action point.
Yeah,
but awesome.
You guys are exciting me. I'm gonna play the butt out of that game.
Slough it, maybe.
I'm Griffin. Who did you roll? I have the pets. I have the robot pets. So I have one right now. I have two pets with me, and one lays like smoke barriers, and then the other shoots, which is cool.
I went with the basic street samurai, like the standard dude who just is like melee and guns. By the time I finished the game, I was maxed on submachine guns, and it was almost a joke, like how much devastation my character could rein in.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm happy with that for the end game, but I also regret like not doing something a little more diverse besides just shooting dudes. But I had a great time with the character that I ended up picking, just because I really enjoyed that overpowered feeling.
I love how they take your class and they work it into like making it through the level. For example, there was a hole in the wall. Like I had to figure out how to get onto another floor and I couldn't take the elevator, and there was a hole in the wall. So I literally put my little robot through the hole, which no other class could do.
That's awesome.
The robot went around and like unlocked the door, which was awesome.
That sounds really cool. When I wrote my review for it, I mentioned Deus Ex Human Revolution, where I felt like it was you had the level design, which was like you have point A and you have point B, yet you have 15, well, you have maybe like 8 different branches of different ways to get from point A to point B. Like you're going to get from one location to the next, and it's like it's not like you're going through a multi-step process to get there, but there are obviously different ways to get to the same goal. However, I think what separates it from Deus Ex is after you finish finding one solution, you can't go back and find other solutions because you're limited by your class, which I found really fun and really helpful for like the replayability of it.
Agreed completely. Yeah, it's very clear. Like, okay, if you spec'd into hacking, you can hack this terminal. Mm-hmm. Or if you spec'd into, I don't know, shamanistic crap, you can trance this person. I don't know. And then like there's one thing for every class.
Yeah.
And so
I think that actually people are kind of discrediting the main story a little bit, only in that they're saying like, oh, just it can be so much cooler with the editor. I think the main game is actually really, really good, especially after you go through it. And it's about 20 hours, 15 to 20 hours you'll be playing it. And it just keeps going. And by the end of it, if you didn't pick one of the kind of weirder class types, like the drone dude or the hacker guy, like they give you enough opportunities to play around with those things by the end of it that you're like, okay, this is really cool.
Mm-hmm. I love the main story. I think that the one thing that I get from the writing is that, and this is fairly unique among games, is that they are respecting the player's intelligence in terms of the characterizations, in terms of like the variety of characters. Like if you see a big troll and he's a bouncer in a club, in any other game that would be just a one-dimensional character.
Yeah.
But in this game, the big troll who's the bouncer at the club is actually like this deep, fascinating character.
Yeah.
And it's like, what other game is going to give you that?
That's exciting.
Yeah. It only gets better. Like there are more and more characters like that in the main story that are just I think this is where it also comes into like the spin-off sounds so appealing, where it's like, hey, let's explore more into that person. Like hopefully somebody can write a good run about that guy, or hopefully somebody can write more stories involving, you know, these people that were already made in the main campaign as jumping off points.
And hey, Kickstarter success.
Hell, right? Yeah. $120 worth it.
Oh, nice.
That's a lot of money.
What else did you get?
Besides three
copies.
I got three copies, my name in the credits, t-shirt, dog tags, box copy, art book, digital copy. It's like way too much than I should have ever gotten.
Yeah.
Like I feel like they definitely were very generous with their rewards, so.
Mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
I hope it goes on to sell, beyond the Kickstarter.
It's doing quite well on Steam.
Yeah. You got a lot of buzz.
Awesome. Cool. So, like, I now want to go back and play, like, the old Fallout games.
Yeah, you should.
Because it's just...
Good old games.
Yeah?
Yes. Go play them. Go play Fallout,
2 is the best
one. Yeah, don't go to 1. I mean, go to 2.
Okay. I will.
Yes. Also, you should watch... If you don't want to play those games, you should go look up the Summer Games Played... Quick, SGPA. No, yeah, that sounds right. Anyway, there was this last week was a charity event, marathon speedrun event going all week. Summer Games Played Quick, and it's like speedrun archives and this other speedrun community. All these guys get together, they marathon speedrun games, take donations. They made like $250,000 in donations. And just go look up Summer Games Done Quick 2013 on YouTube or go to their website, and it is some of the most fun stuff to watch ever. Like,
oh yeah, it's a Speed Demos archive. I know these guys.
Yes, it is so good. I would highly recommend watching the Ocarina of Time speedrun simply because of the narration. The guy Cosmo who's talking about everything while he's playing the game, it's not only amazing because he is both playing to such a high level and also giving a fantastic like tapestry of the back. He's weaving this tapestry of a backstory for how the speedrun came to be. Like, you know, the game ends up being finished in something like it's less than an hour, whatever it is. So he ends up playing Ocarina of Time in less than an hour, and he's going through this full story, which starts like, well, people had it down to this amount of time, and then this was found, and then, you know, people thought this was as good as it could get, and then eventually this one person found this hack, and then this one person found this other hack, and then this one person found this way to just jump straight to credits after this, but now... It's actually quicker to do this where you actually have to play the game and get to the credits and these, you know, it's just going through these step-by-step history of how this has evolved to be the thing it is. It's fascinating. And it's amazing doing this.
I actually really like speedruns, and I had a period of time where I would watch a lot of tool-assisted speedruns. Are you familiar with the distinction, Griffin?
Yeah, I really don't have any interest in tool-assisted speedruns.
Yeah. You prefer the live ones?
Yeah. I understand their place. I think they're really cool that's where like the hard work goes in, like the discoveries are made, and like the most optimum things can be done there. But I think there's something a lot more interesting in the
For me, I think tool assisted speedruns are cool. Like sometimes the best ones can be like sometimes they can be a form of expression. Of the speedrunners or of the speedrunner. Other times, just like seeing like a critical path through a game, just like seeing it utterly broken or like some weird shit going on for me is really entertaining. I mean, you know, obviously there comes a point with any speedrun where like it gets so broken by being utterly optimized that it's not fun to watch anymore. But yeah, I used to watch tool-assisted speedruns all the time, and I'm remembering some of the stuff from the Ocarina video. I actually saw a Majora video where they finished Majora's Mask in 2 cycles.
Yeah. Whoa. Well, that's got to be a tool assisted though, right? Because like two and a half, I think, is what some of the length of the video. Like 2 hours, 2.5 hours was the marathon for Summer Games Done Quick.
Mm-hmm. Did you? Yeah.
And, I would also recommend
Mario.
Watching.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, please watch this guy named Cypher. He did a run of A Link to the Past, and he does it like in an hour 50 or something like that. and it's really cool. And this is why I think the non-tool assisted speedruns are more interesting, and especially this event, is because these dudes are in a room surrounded by, you know, 20 or 30 people, and then he's like, okay, now this is this new strat I just have been working on for the last 6 months, and he puts a bomb down, swings a sword, takes two pixel steps to the left, two to the right, and then lets his sword go, explodes, and gets like bounced and then reset, like, you know, way further away than he actually should be, and the crowd goes crazy. Like, he does this thing that I don't even understand, and everybody is just going bananas.
Ocarina
for
or Link to the Past?
Link to the Past. And even in Ocarina, okay, like some of these frames, it's like a fighting game.
Yeah,
I think
in,
is
in
why
Ocarina,
I really enjoy
you could
it.
Do a cool bomb glitch with your sword that sends you backwards really fast.
Yeah, but I think it's that frame level precision and like inventiveness that I'm so interested in. And how people have to do it on the fly, and kind of it reminds me of fighting games. As like it's so demanding that it's something that I can appreciate, but I can't understand. And the
yeah, I think you get the inventiveness in the tool assisted variant or varieties, but I don't know. I guess I like the tool assisted because in a sense for me they're more democratic, and I've never really liked, like, I enjoy watching fighting games, but I don't like how fighting game, like, part of fighting games is how learning the actual inputs, like performing the inputs, is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
That part of fighting games has always turned me off. So like the high pressure, high stress, you know, high difficulty element of it isn't as interesting to me as like the inventiveness and the creativeness that is applied to like solving a game. So I think that's why I gravitate more towards the tool assisted variety. I was going to say, Jamie, did you know that Mario 64 has been beaten by humans with only 16 stars collected? I've actually beaten it with only 16 stars.
Wow.
How do you do that? That's insane.
You can use backwards long jumping.
Go watch the videos. Go look up these people's stuff, because they did one this year, and
it's awesome.
It's so awesome. Like, so cool.
I'm being quiet because I have to be quiet, but this whole conversation I've been like bugging out with excitement.
We should link him to like Speed Demos Archive and websites like that, so you can get a sense of what these things look like. But yeah, people do all kinds of research. Actually, with tool assisted speed runs, Mario's been beaten with 0 stars, which is just insane.
That's amazing.
But the 16 stars, yeah, you could do that on an N64. It's not even that hard. It's really cool.
Craziness. So.
Anyway.
Insanity. I think we should probably cut it off here. I don't know how much else is on that document that's pertinent. Jeff, is there much left on there that you want to go over?
I think we pretty much covered it all, and I'm getting pretty damn tired.
Yeah, so let's put a bow on it and call this one an episode or whatever. Right.
Love it.
All right, Jeff Brewer, James Scherer, thank you both for talking at large about video games.
Sorry for being tired as hell.
Hey, it's okay.
Sorry for being quiet.
It's okay. It's okay. we'll see you guys next week, and video games are really cool.
They are. I like them.
I concur. Give me your address.